Hi, I'm Jason Plotkin, and you're listening to Drinking and Droshing, Tour with a Twist. And this episode took a lot of collaboration, especially with my partner in crime over here.
Hey, Amanda.
What's up, Gabe?
So, we finished Genesis. We're all done.
Yeah, I know. That was last week, wasn't it?
Yeah, we're totally done with it, and now we get to start a brand new book.
I love reading.
Yeah, I know you do. And because it's a brand new book, I'm sure that you've brought in some excellent new people who I've never met before and who know nothing about the podcast and who are totally brand new to this circle of friends.
Okay, so hear me out. Just in the same way that we've been taught to turn it again, so too have I noticed that sometimes the best experts that we've been able to have on our show are people who have, been on our show before.
Wait, are you saying that these are returning guests?
Actually, what I'm saying is we've got a brand new type of episode where we have two different returning Q&A guests that are now on a team to be the featured guests for today's episode.
Wow, it's like we said turn it and turn it and turn it again with our Rolodex.
Haha, what's a Rolodex? While it may not be the first episode of 2023, we are excited to say that it is the first parsha of a brand new book. So we're coming at you with Exodus, otherwise known in Hebrew as Shemot. Now that's confusing because the book Shemot is also the name of the first parsha Shemot, which just means names. But if you think all we're going to do is read a list of names to you, well, yeah, no, that is how the book starts. But we're going to skip that part, I think. More on that when Gabe does his Parsha rundown. But don't worry about it. It's okay. Today, we're really excited because we're looking at Exodus through a different type of lens, a new lens that we haven't talked about so much on this podcast, which is strange because we've always felt like a family, like this was a familial podcast passion project. So get excited because our guests today are a first-time duo repeat. Both of them came from different episodes as Q&A guests, and today they are here together as a team to be our featured guests. Aliza and Jason Plotkin are a pair of Jewish communal professionals hailing from West Bloomfield, Michigan. Aliza is an early childhood consultant and a member of the National Council of Jewish Women, NCJW board, and she's awesome. Jason is the executive director of Temple Israel in West Bloomfield, and Gabe Snyder's number one fan and our podcast statistician. Just kidding, not really, but he's also awesome. The Plotkin family recently moved to Michigan from Houston along with their son Isaac, who is 7 and was adopted at birth. Isaac is a transracial adoptee. As both parents and professionals, the Plotkins have a very relationship-based approach to how they approach the world and their Jewish values. Aliza, Jason, welcome back to the show. We're so excited to be with you. We've been talking about it all week long, and man, how wonderful to get to celebrate the beginning of a new book together.
It's so good to be here. Yeah, it's excited to have a conversation, excited to be here with Jason. Jason and I both frequently have these sorts of conversations, but it's not often that we get to have them together.
And any time I get to spend with this crew is fantastic in my book. A great way to start the new year.
That's so nice. And also, I can already see Gabe tearing up. Gabe, how is it to be reunited with your favorite team, Plotkin?
I'm so excited. This is going to be a great episode.
Incredible. And as always, our incredible executive producer, Edan, who makes sure that these episodes come out so beautifully and who puts up with our jokes and our numbers. Edan, it's so exciting to be with you. How do you feel to be reunited with Team Plotkin?
It's so great to see them again. It's been a minute. So good to be together.
Wonderful. I'm so excited to just dive in. Let's go into the second book of the Torah.
Shemot Shemot, that means names. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, and Joseph all have kids and then promptly die, leaving behind a whole lot of descendants who were actually doing pretty well in Egypt. Not so fast, says a new pharaoh afraid of the Jews. He enslaves all of them and orders the midwives to kill Hebrew infant boys. The midwives, Shifra and Pua, are like, yeah, we're not doing that. And so they made up a lie about how Hebrew women are just too good at giving birth, so by the time the midwives get there, the baby's already been born. Apparently, only one kind of Israelite labor was difficult in Egypt. Pharaoh wasn't thrilled, so he ordered all the baby boys to be thrown into the Nile. Hey, who's that? It's Yocheved, and she has a son, but they're Israelites, so the baby is going to be killed. Yocheved puts the baby in a basket and floats the basket down the river, and the baby's sister follows the basket, and when the baby is found by none other than Pharaoh's daughter, the sister offers to find a Hebrew nurse for the child. Surprise, it's Yocheved. Family reunion. Nice. Pharaoh's daughter adopts the baby and names him Moses, which means something like out from the water. I wonder if that will be a theme in this book of Torah. Fast forward and Moses is grown up and he goes out and sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew and he looks around and, seeing nobody around, intervenes himself, striking and killing the Egyptian. Moses hides the body in the sand, and just when Moses thinks he can get away with the murder, another Hebrew mentions the killing. Well, thinks Moses, cat's out of the bag, I gotta run. So he runs all the way to Midian, where he comes upon a well where the priest of Midian's seven daughters are trying to get water, but some shepherds are giving them a hard time. Moses defends the girls and helps feed the flock. Hey, look, water and redemption, cool theme. The daughters return to their father Reuel, who may have a different name later, and they tell him the story of the mysterious Egyptian who helped them. Reuel is quite happy with Moses and has him stay for dinner, and also gives him his daughter Tzipora as a wife. They have a kid named Gershom, saying, I have been a stranger in a strange land. Fast forward again, and surprise, the Israelites are still suffering back in Egypt, and they cry out to God, and surprise, God actually hears them this time. So one day, when Moses is out in the wilderness tending to a flock of sheep, God speaks to him through a bush that's burning, but not really. God has Moses take off his shoes before making quite the introduction. I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. Moses is pretty freaked out, but God continues, saying that the Israelites are suffering and that it's Moses' job to lead them to freedom. But why me? Asks Moses. Because I said so, but don't worry, I've got your back. Oh, and by the way, at some point we'll meet again at this very spot. So Moses has some more questions, namely about God's name, to which God responds, Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh, tell the people Ehyeh sent you. They'll get it. I certainly don't. God shows Moses how to do a couple of cool magic tricks and encourages Moses about his speech impediment, and Moses goes back to his father-in-law, whose name is now Yitro for some reason, and tells him that he's going back to Egypt. God says to Moses, when you return to Egypt, I will stiffen Pharaoh's heart and he will not let the people go, so there's going to be some extra steps to this whole thing. Seems unnecessary, but okay. Oh, by the way, Tzipora, who is not an Israelite, circumcises their son to keep God from killing them, so that's cool, I guess. Moses has a brother named Aaron, and they have a nice reunion scene, and Moses explains to the Israelites what's happening before going to meet Pharaoh. Pharaoh's not super into the whole let my people go thing, so he gives the Israelites even more work to do. Nice going, Moses. Moses goes to God and says, hey, what's up with that? God responds, give it time. And that's Parashat Shemot.
That was a fantastic explanation, and, you know, the number one thing that I kind of heard when you were talking about that was Moses' story was formed in trauma, and all adoption kind of comes from that lens. Even the good stories, you know, our Isaac, our son, is a domestic infant adoption, which means he was adopted at birth in an open adoption, which also has very different connotation depending on who the family is. What open legally means is that you know the names of each other. The people, the first family and the adoptive parents know the names and kind of the stories, and then how each family does that is different. But that really spoke to me. And then is that that's Moses' story. And then also the fact that he has to become the spokesperson for a whole thing. Like he didn't sign up for this, right? Like, his story is his story because of all of these other factors, yet he lands with all of that on his plate. And when we're thinking about that in kind of modern day times and what that means for all children, adoptive children, birth children, whatever, is they come with these histories. And that looks a lot of different ways. And it kind of starts laying their path. And what they do with that, though, is their own. I don't know. What did it ring for you?
You know, every time I hear Gabe do one of these stories, especially as it relates to Pesach, for me, I think of my family's tradition of saying, who knows one, who know, you know, doing that part of the Passover Seder without a breath. And I'm just always blown away by Gabe. So it's so neat to see him go through the steps and then to hear you relate our story to the story that Gabe just told. Gabe's always is able to bring it like to modern times in an easy to understand way. And I liked your relation back to that story. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you both. I'm really excited to discuss it with you further.
Aliza, Jason, I've had the pleasure of both getting to meet and talk with Isaac, but also getting to hear a little bit about your story. And I know that you've shared a little in your bio, and I know that you've shared a little based in the rundown we just had. But one of the things that I've been thinking about in terms of family, and especially in Passover when we're kind of focused on the family structure, is this idea of chosen family and what that looks like for people. And so I was wondering if you might be willing to take us down kind of the choices that you made in terms of becoming a family who chose to adopt, and the moment that Isaac also helped choose you as his parents.
Yeah, so adoption and the choice for adoption was for us a kind of long-winded conversation. It was always something I was interested in. And even before I think we were ready to have a family, friends of ours kind of started adoption. And as the path to parenthood started to look really challenging for us, and have its different draws and its different, I really wanted to explore that. And exploring that means a lot of different things, which I think is really important to kind of note here, because when people hear adoption, they're like, oh, I know someone who's adopted, and they all are kind of the same thing. They're all really different. And so there is domestic infant adoption, which is the process that we adopted Isaac with, which is where you're kind of matched with a person either pre-birth or shortly after birth, and the parents are making the choice. They are kind of saying, like, this is what we want, and that's that process. There's also the foster care system, which it's important to note when I say that, I mean children who have already gone through the process of being, their parental rights have been terminated. Because when we talk about foster care, it's really, really important to say, like, if you're becoming a foster parent, you're doing that because you want to support reunification. So that's that conversation. But then there's also children who, unfortunately, like, that's no longer an option for them. So that's another path to adoption. And then the third path is international adoption, which you also see a lot in the Jewish community. I think growing up, that was really my understanding of adoption, kind of 80s, 90s kid. So there were lots of choices. Like, even once we kind of entered the idea of adoption, the next choice was greater. And Jason came to the choice a little differently because of a friend. And it kind of took that. I don't know if you want to speak more to that.
Yeah. So I'll say, like, until I was like 30, I was not exposed to adoption. I don't think, you know, maybe it was around me and I didn't know, it wasn't talked about. But I worked at the University of New Orleans in the athletic department, and our men's basketball coach, who I did public relations for, was going through a foster to adopt situation. And as Aliza mentioned, the goal of foster care is to reunite. And they had a child for just over a year, and it was this national story. They couldn't say anything about the kid or anything specific about the family, but the coach really shined light on foster care and adoption. And we as a team, as a family, because we traveled together, we were on airplanes, through the, you know, busing all through the middle of the night, we really got to know as a team, as a family, about this situation. And it really shined light for me, not only on adoption, but this men's basketball coach is white, his wife is Black, and they, throughout various adoption and foster processes, have brought in different, you know, as a white man, he brought in, you know, his daughter is a Black young lady, his son is a white child. So, you know, there's just various racial challenges that he faces as a white father of a Black child that, you know, I had someone to lean into. And again, I was not exposed till I was about 30. And, you know, Isaac, you know, came a few years later, but I probably would not have felt sure about what to do about adoption without that experience. So, I mean, even, you know, Lisa said, as we were making choices, we found families that subsequently had ties to other things in my life that had adopted children as adults. And it really opened our eyes and gave us a different perspective.
And with that, I think also leaning into the experts, like the adult adoptees in our life, and really kind of the people in our lives who were the experts, because, you know, we're really here talking about this from the parenting angle, but I think it's important to say, like, the real experts in adoption are always going to be adoptees. And that's really important for us and has been very important for us.
You know, it occurs to me that the story of Moses within this Torah portion really is a story about Moses' shifting and complicated identity. We start the story with Moses being born to an Israelite woman who is named, which is not always the case. He is put out in a basket on the river and is adopted and, frankly, named by Batya, by Pharaoh's daughter. And he's given this name that's an Egyptian name, and he grows up. And we don't get a lot of detail about his childhood. Any detail we really have comes out of Midrash, or, you know, the Prince of Egypt, which is also Midrash, but in a different way. Eventually, he goes out, he sees an Egyptian beating an Israelite, and what the Torah says is he sees the Egyptian beating one of his countrymen, beating one of his people. So there's this running question of, does Moses know that he's an Israelite? Does Moses identify as an Israelite? Does he identify as Egyptian? And then he runs off to Midian, where he integrates into that community. He becomes a shepherd, and the son-in-law of the high priest of Midian marries a Midianite woman, and then has to go back to Egypt, where on the way, he is not the one who circumcises his son per Israelite custom. And this whole thing is just very complicated. There's a lot of shifting loyalties and identities within Moses, and frankly, around Moses, the way he's seen by the other Israelites, by Pharaoh, by the Midianites. When he rescues the girls, they say, you know, this random Egyptian guy saved us. So I'm really curious about this kind of playing with identity, not even playing with this, the idea of coming into the world in an identity that doesn't necessarily match the identity with which you're surrounded. Or more accurately, having a complicated identity, having an identity that isn't so succinctly explained by, hi, I'm Gabe and I'm a Jewish white man. It's complicated. And I'm curious if you could speak more to that from your experience as, I believe the word you used in your bio was transracial adoptees or adopters.
So we are a transracial family, and Isaac is a transracial adoptee. I think that's such a great question and has been a really, really, really important part of kind of Isaac's whole life, is trying to make sure he has a really firm identity and knows who he is. You know, when we talk about the Parsha, there's a little bit of this contradiction, right? Like, to be an Israeli and Egyptian, battles. And fortunately, being a Black Jew isn't. There is a possibility. And I shouldn't say there isn't. There is lots of complexities that I am not someone I can speak to, that should speak to those. But at least in this case, it's a thing.
Well, I think what's, you know, interesting for us is it's important for us to expose Isaac to his culture as a Black person. We have been very fortunate over the years, whether it was when we were in Houston or now, to have individuals who are Black that are in his circle as adults, as role models, as mentors. And that's just been very critical for Isaac's upbringing. And he certainly, you know, understands that mom and dad are white and XYZ, whoever I'm referring to, are Black people in the community. And I think that's important for us as parents to always ensure he has that kind of exposure to people of color.
Yeah, and those relationships are really important, and fostering those relationships. Before we adopted, someone said to us, like, you can't be your child's, like, your child can't be your first Black friend. And we have found that really true. We were, because of the lives we had lived in, you know, Jason's jobs and the colleges we had gone to and the lives we had had, we were very fortunate to have diverse communities to lean into, because this was one of those, like, love isn't enough. We will never fully get it. And that means finding people for him to stand firm in that identity with. But that also means we get to also really embrace that Jewish identity strongly, because we've found the people to help us with the Black identity. And for us, the Jewish identity, we've raised Isaac as Jewish community professionals. The way our former rabbi puts it is, the people in our synagogue are the people in the neighborhood. You know, if you think kind of Mr. Rogers, that's his community, that's his neighborhood. That's where he feels the most confident. So it's really kind of wonderful watching all of those parts of him come out. Recently, we were at a party for the Jewish Black Coalition, and he was just the most confident I've seen him. It was a room full of 100 people, and he pulled up a chair and asked for the microphone so that he could sing a Hanukkah song in this room full of mostly adults, because I think in that room, he saw so much of who he was, and he was being celebrated in such a unique way. And it was really special for us. And I don't know if he would have done it in another spot.
I think that one of the things that we notice a lot, especially in terms of family systems, is that there are stories that often get muddled. And so I want to just attach one quick correction to something Gabe said earlier, and then I'm going to jump into a new question, which was, Yocheved at the time of Moses' birth actually isn't named. She's not named till a whole couple of books later, close to the end of chapter 26 in the book of Numbers, which is insane, by the way, if you think about it. But generally, when we're talking about Yocheved, the reason that we are able to do is that we make the connection much later in Numbers 26:59, where it says the name of Amram's wife was Yocheved, daughter of Levi, who was born to Levi in Egypt. She bore to Amram Aaron and Moses and their sister Miriam. And that's how we get to where we were today. But our family systems tend to be muddled, and our stories are like special shared stories that sometimes are right and sometimes are more fiction than fact, but they're important and they help us, you know, make who we are. And so you just spoke really beautiful about the fact that Isaac leaned into his Jewish identity in terms of a place where he felt really comfortable and felt himself, because he kind of felt people like him in the room. And so I wanted to ask, and I know this is something you've both spoken to me about before, about this idea of adoption as a Jewish value. And I am bringing this up mostly because Moses is just one example of adoption that we can see in our text. But also, if we look elsewhere, we have Naomi inherently adopting Ruth's son. We have Mordechai, who inherently acts as an adoptive father for Esther. And so there are people who are even royalty bound, you know, who have been adopted and had these incredible family stories and systems that change. And so, Aliza, Jason, as two Jewish parents and Jewish professionals, how do you see adoption playing into a Jewish value?
That's such a great question. So frequently, we don't talk about adoption in a Jewish narrative and a Jewish lens almost at all. It's something, as I have kind of been part of the adoption community and learned from people, it's really frequently talked about in Christian churches. Like, it's a big narrative there. And we don't have that. And I think that's okay. Like, I don't always think the narrative in those churches is healthy. So I'm not suggesting we take that. But what I do think we should take on is that conversation of adoption as a Jewish value and the inclusivity and the knowledge that there is children who are in need, and how are we supporting them, and how are we lifting up adoptive families, and how are we encouraging families to adopt, and kind of more opening the conversation also of education around adoption within our full community, because I think that's been our experience as we started the adoption process and as we've lived, you know, with an adopted child now for 7 years, like, there is just not a lot of education throughout the whole community or understanding. And I think that those values really can come through in that way also.
Yeah, I agree with Aliza. I think the education is a key component. When we were in Houston, I did speak to some audiences about adoption and our experience, because I wasn't exposed till I was 30. And I think as people are establishing themselves as professionals and other things, not just in the Jewish community, but outside, it's important to expose to that. And the other thing I'll say is, even, you know, I obviously am at a Reformed synagogue. I don't think our clergy, and this might be good for our two clergy to be counterparts on this call, but are aware necessarily of resources for families of transracial adoptees or Jews of color. I think we're finally picking up on some interfaith conversations, and how to work with interfaith families is becoming at the forefront. And I think the next frontier, if you will, if it's not already slowly picking up steam, is how we deal with Jews of color and how we provide them resources and resources to families like our own, because there's things outside the Reform movement in the Jewish community that can be beneficial as resources, as education, both for the clergy, for the community itself, or for these families going through what we're going through as parents of a Black child.
Yeah. And I think for all families, you know, adoption is, and different family structures are so important when we think about inclusivity and LGBTQIA families and the ways families are made. The more people are armed with information and know-how, and the kind of better off we'll be. We really had to piece together the support, and we were lucky. We had great clergy that were willing to do the work to be there to support us. But we also did have some really rough experiences as we tried to kind of wade into adoption with the Jewish community, and then times of just not always feeling included. I joke that those like baby classes or those like pregnancy classes, those were the worst, because by the time babies came, everyone had like been together in these like, I guess, pregnancy courses and like sat in like months of stuff. So like it was kind of, my experience wasn't seen in the same way. So like when I would walk in with Isaac, it was like, they had already formed that community. So I'd love to kind of reframe and think about, like, and that's not to say those programs shouldn't exist. Those programs are incredible and absolutely should exist. But what else is out there? Because the tent has to be widened and we have to really be thinking about it, because I know for a fact we weren't the only family that wasn't our experience.
I'm thinking about how these adoption narratives are in something that are centered in our community. They're very much on the periphery, not only in terms of, you know, what we plan for and what we talk about, but also in terms of like our stories and our liturgy. We get so much about, you know, these pregnancy narratives and these narratives in our sacred texts and in our tradition about barren women who cry and pray and then conceive or something similar. And we don't get a lot of these adoption narratives. And that's why they're so interesting and special when we get them, whether it's Moses or the ones that Amanda named. One other that I wanted to just name and lift up is a different kind of adoption narrative. It's not quite as fruitful as the Moses narrative, but one that I think is interesting is that just in the last book, back in Genesis, when Jacob blesses all of his sons, he also takes Ephraim and Manasseh and says, "These are sons of mine, just like Reuben and Simeon." And to this day, we, in our traditional blessing for boys, we say Yisimcha Elohim ke Ephraim v'kemenashe. We say, "May God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh." So these are two examples of people we don't have huge narratives on. We don't have the narratives of Moses or Ruth or Esther, certainly, but people who certainly live on in our tradition. And they're sons of Jacob, just like Reuben and Simeon. It kind of reverberates for me in the same way that we say a convert should always be treated the same as a person who is born into the Jewish community. And so I am curious about these moments where there is pushback, where there is stigma, or where there is a feeling of being othered or otherness, where maybe the adoptee or the adoptive parents aren't quite seen as being a part of the community. A, what does that resonate with you? And B, have you seen on the flip side a way in which it's been done right, a way in which it's been done well?
Coming from my education background, you know, I think there's definitely examples I've seen, especially when talking about kind of history and ancestry, which is something we talk a lot about as Jews. And it is important for us to talk about, because I think that's one of the most important things to say is, like, when you were talking about an adoptee, they have multiple histories. Like, we, you know, all of that is true, and it's really important. Each family, the way they kind of address that and talk about that might look really different. So one of the most common ones you see is, like, family tree projects in religious school. Like, thinking through how you're talking about those sorts of things and what it might mean to a child and what is really the goal there. And is there a way to kind of do that? And I think it's important because lineage is important. It's okay to acknowledge for people that's meaningful for. But I always ask in those times, what is the way we can make room and kind of just broaden it and make the conversation more inclusive? I think those are the moments. I've talked a little bit previously about kind of the being a new parent and what that felt like. That was really challenging. But overwhelmingly, I think it goes back to that education where I have felt moments of kind of othering has really come from a lack of education or, unfortunately, a lack of bias and assumption. You know, I think moving to a new community in our has been an example of that. Just, you know, people don't know Isaac's story. So sometimes there might be assumptions made. So I think people just need to think broader and ask those sorts of questions. What about you? What's your experience been?
Yeah, I think the assumptions thing is a challenge in our communities. I think people do make assumptions with not truly having an understanding of where they're coming from. I think it's hard to break from the bias that you have in your mind. And that's just maybe what some people know. But yeah, I really believe the assumptions are a challenge and people can't assume things. Especially now more than ever, I think. I think all of our assumptions that may have existed in some respects have kind of disappeared. Society has changed rapidly in the last few years, and how family structures and how people end up in circumstances are completely different than anything we know. So I just think assumptions I feel like we all need to be Mythbusters, if you will.
And I think on like a really base level, like a lot of things we do and structures we still have are based on this very like heteronormative, patriarchal structure. And we just need to look at everything with a fine tooth comb to make sure everything we're presenting is coming through with more broader lens. Like, I know getting, you know, parent one, parent two, because we do have children in guardianship situations, for example. And I don't think people assume a Jewish child wouldn't be in that situation or whatever. And we just need to think broader and make sure we're making room for everyone and what feels good.
So that's something that speaks really beautifully and to me and meaningfully to me. My maternal grandfather actually grew up in an orphanage, which he ran away from when he was 17. And I have no history of his side of the family because all the records in that orphanage, the orphanage burned down. And so family trees are complicated, and doing them in schools can be a really complicated place when you are seeing like a section of your tree that just does not exist. And so I think for me, one of the things that I think about, we don't do this a lot, listeners, but hopefully you'll bear with me, is that this story of Yocheved and Bat Paro and Moses actually shows up in our Talmud. Now, the Talmud is an oral Torah. It's an oral tradition. It's actually commentary on an oral tradition, which was the Mishnah. But here in a place called Sanhedrin 19b, and in Sanhedrin, we were talking about court systems and justice systems and how we define things, right? Like how legally things were defined. And here there's a really beautiful statement that says, anybody who raised someone, it's as if that they had given birth to that person. And when you talk about getting rid of assumptions, right, when you talk about getting rid of the, oh, are you new here or do you belong here or insert thing that we're thinking that maybe we shouldn't have actually said out loud here, you know, there is something to be said about the fact that even through the adoptive process, you are Isaac's mother and you are Isaac's father and you are the ones that are raising Isaac. And so in that way, even though you weren't part of the pregnancy classes, it is as if you had given birth to Isaac and the person that Isaac is today. And I think that I really agree with both of you that a lot of Jewish organizations aren't well equipped to have those conversations and aren't necessarily as well equipped to deal with kind of the intersectionality of identity. And Aliza, I'm going to push a little bit maybe harder on you on this one as an early childhood educator of what we might be able to do better in terms of bringing people into our communities under that Jewish value, that people who have raised people in their home, it's as if they are, in fact, had given birth to those people.
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And I want to add, as we say that, something that I take real pride in is I am Isaac's mother, and his first mother is also his mother. And as he kind of grows and changes, that relationship is kind of always on the table because, again, those origin stories are so important and we want to make sure those are important. But again, it doesn't make me less of a mother. It makes me, you know, really lucky in a way because there is so much love for kind of my kid out there who you might be hearing right now. Well, it's funny. We met someone the other day and he was telling them, they said, why are you black and your parents are white? And like, he told them the whole adoption story because he's says it with pride. Amanda, for your question you asked kind of as an early childhood educator, what we can do and how we can think differently. And I think that's really important because we are one of those first entry points into a synagogue. And I think it all starts with those relationships and learning who is out there and what sort of family structures exist, and then looking at things and just making those adjustments. I also think we have a lot to learn about how we welcome people and how we learn about people from other religious organizations and other structures. Recently, a colleague, Emily Arnoff, went to a church seminar and a program for early childhood educators working in that structure. And she wrote this beautiful blog about it. And I was really taken aback by her learnings there. And it inspired me. And I think that we have a lot to learn because, again, other communities have had these conversations in a little bit more structure. And we want to bring them back in our own ways. I'm not saying we want to bring them back in the exact ways because we always want to add our lens. But I think really going out there and seeing what's around could be really helpful.
And so, Jason, because I asked Aliza a pointed question, you know that I have one that's coming at you as our numbers statistician person. Is there or are there any either number points or I would say bold bullet points that you would want us to know as Jewish professionals in the field or as people looking at adoption in a Jewish community that like you're like, listen, like this is what you should know about this particular situation. And here's what adoption can look like in the Jewish community. Or here's what I've found out in my experience.
I think it's important just to learn who your people are and what their stories are. I think in Jason's ideal synagogue space, a lot of relationships drive community. And it's important to learn who your folks are. I think it's hard to make judgment calls and assumptions and really have an idea of who's who without knowing who people are. So it's important to spend a little time, talk to folks. You know, one of the great things about being the new executive director is a lot of people don't know who I am. So I have a very easy access point to learning more about them. And the other thing I'll say is people will see me. I remember the first day of Sunday school, Isaac and I played on the playground for an hour and a half after Sunday school. I forget where Aliza was. I think she's actually out of town at a NCJW thing. But like this woman was who was black and had a black child, was so excited to see a black child. And I don't think I said I was the executive director until like an hour into that 90-minute window. And I think the woman was absolutely blown away that there was someone coming into the community. So I think it's important to build the relationships, really get to know people so you can be a better partner, better ally, colleague, friend, et cetera.
And I think that is part of it, is unfortunately it is one size fits all in these conversations. So it's why it would be so easy to kind of, you know, give the cut and dry answer. There isn't one because family structures look so different. And I think it's also important to note, so in our family, because we are a transracial adoptive family, it's very easy to note and assume, okay, that's an adoption situation. But a lot of families by adoption are same race, and you might not know if you meet someone later in life. So never make assumptions about anyone. And also you don't know why or how someone came into adoption. You don't know the backstory. And I know personally we share obviously the broader parts of Isaac's adoption story. Like we've made a very cognizant choice not to share his story because that's his kind of decision to make when he reaches that age. Just unfortunately, you've got to get to know people and build those relationships. And not unfortunately, fortunately, because that's what's so beautiful. And that's what Jewish values teach us.
There is no one size fits all. And so I'm not going to ask you to like solve all of the problems right now in your next answer. However, we do ask all of our guests, and you've both been on the show before, and you're both avid listeners of the podcast, so you knew this question was coming. If you, and I'll give you each one, so you really get two. If you had one piece of wisdom, one bit of knowledge, one something, one call to action that you wanted to leave listeners with, what do you want people to walk away with after listening to this episode?
Turn to the experts. There is so many incredible voices out there, whether it be Black Jews, adoptees. Those are two separate groups, to be explicitly clear. Some Black Jews are adoptees, absolutely not all. Just turn to people, listen to the stories, listen to the voices that are out there. There is so much beauty to be shared and so much wisdom to gain from people's lived experiences. And when we try to kind of box everything into one assumption or one color, it doesn't work. So when we're really able to sit down and listen and learn, a whole new world is exposed to us and a new way to engage in the world. And it's really beautiful. So listen to the experts is my call to action.
I would say find an organization that serves Jews of color in particular and like dive in, learn who they are, learn what services they provide. I think a lot of the challenges that we see are people are not aware of these organizations that are providing services to maybe niche populations. Doesn't necessarily have to be transracial adoptee, you know, but there's organizations and groups out there that are doing great work. And I think anything we can do to elevate them and highlight them in our own communities goes a long way in making us whole as a Jewish community.
Yeah, I think people often think they have to reinvent the wheel or solve all the problems. And don't get me wrong, there's always problems that have to be solved, but there's also a lot of great people out there and great organizations doing really good things.
I think Aliza just took my pitch to why, like, I find myself really into being involved in the reform movement, professional organizations. It's like knowing who your tools are and who are the best people to go to in certain situations. Like, that's why, you know, we have an Amanda Weiss, a Gabe Snyder, Edon. You guys are networks. Y'all are part of this greater community. And like, I know I can come to you guys for X, Y, Z, just like I hope other people feel they can come to me for other things. Like, that's what makes this Jewish community strong, is we lean on others to be our best tools.
I think that's called collaboration.
Collaboration. There you go. Good word.
Hey, Gabe.
Hey, Amanda.
It occurs to me that we don't really know Moses' name before it was Moses.
Yeah, I guess not.
And that we're told that Moshe is named Moshe because Bat Paro, Pharaoh's daughter, drew him out of the water. And so that's what it meant, was this idea of drawing out.
Yeah, no, that's kind of the etymology given. I'm not entirely sure that's correct. I'm not sure what the Egyptian word would be, but yeah, that's what the Torah says.
So I'll tell you, I have noticed that each week you come up with a Midrashic mixology section and you have to have a very challenging but fun opportunity of naming the drinks each week. Is that true?
That's true. I name all of the drinks myself, or I have Amanda do it. One of those two things generally happens.
So would you say that today you may have drawn your name from this week's Torah portion?
You know, I certainly found a name that was inspired by some of the Torah portion. Yeah. So this week, we're going to do the Nile River breeze. Moses needed to get away from Egypt, and let's be real, we could all use a break. So, vacation cocktail time. Start with 2 ounces of rum in an ice-filled shaker, because nothing says tropical vacation like a rum beverage. For some sweetness in Moses' new life with Tzipporah and her family, add in 1 ounce of almond liqueur. Add in a splash of cranberry juice for the blood of the Egyptian, and a splash of pineapple juice, because this is a vacation cocktail and it just feels right. For a non-alcoholic Nile breeze, swap out the rum and almond liqueur for 3 ounces of coconut water with a dash of almond extract. Shake all of that up and pour over fresh ice into a cocktail glass. If you shake it up really well, you should have a nice foam on top. To finish it off, add a couple drops of vanilla extract over top. This will add some bitterness and contrast to all that sweetness, but with a nice comforting scent. Sounds kind of complex, sort of like this story. May this new book and new year of 2023 be nice and breezy. L'chaim.
I always appreciate a tropical drink. So we love to vacation in Mexico. And previously when we were living in Texas, it was very close. Unfortunately, not so much anymore. And I do love me a tropical drink. So the coconut rum thing. But what this actually reminded me of is when Isaac first went to an all-inclusive resort in Mexico and he heard people talking about a Shirley Temple drink, he started calling them temple drinks. And we quickly realized that he thought everyone was ordering like a temple drink, like a synagogue drink. So he still refers to Shirley Temple's as the temple drink. So I will take your sea breeze, but Isaac will take the temple drink.
As long as it's not made by a sisterhood anywhere.
We love sisterhoods. We love sisterhoods.
Yeah. Well, maybe next week we'll do a Shirley synagogue. But for now, yeah, Amanda reminded me that I forgot to pitch our store. You can find it at store.drinkinganddroshing.com, where we have a wonderful onesie for all of the babies in your life. That has our Drinking and Droshing logo on the front, and on the back has a wonderful quote from Psalm 23, "My bottle runneth over." So if that interests you, you can find it at store.drinkinganddroshing.com.
So I will say that with this episode, both my cup and my bottle seem to have runneth over. But I'm really delighted with talking about a topic that I'll be honest about. I didn't know so much about going into this episode, and I feel really excited to learn more about as someone who is about to be ordained and become a clergy member. I think it's really always wonderful to have something that you can keep learning about and just embracing new resources, as Aliza and Jason both spoke about. And so for us, I will say, and with real thanks to Team Plotkin for this, based on Aliza's suggestion of focusing on adoption for this particular parsha, it did occur to me that in Shemot, in the first three chapters, we're actually introduced to three different ways of establishing a family, some of which we talked about during this episode. So in chapter one, we establish family through a genealogy, a history. That's our family tree, right? The names that Gabe went through very quickly. There are even more names, but he skipped a lot of them. That's okay. The second through chapter two, we get adoption. You know, we get Bat Paro drawing Moses out of the water. And in chapter three, God actually brings up to Moses that Moses has a brother, Aaron, who Moses didn't know about because why would he? Or Aaron isn't mentioned in chapter one or chapter two. In fact, he's not mentioned at all until God brings Aaron into the family. So that's kind of being introduced to a distant or an estranged family member. But we've talked a lot about this idea that Shemot, the basis for our Passover Seder story, is really based in family celebration, family observation. And so my hope is that this episode might be helpful even when we are at Passover time as a replay. And so Aliza, Jason, Gabe, how can we help redefine or reimagine what a Jewish family can look like today, even after the Torah did so well many, many centuries ago?
Family is anything you make of it, and chosen family is so important. And as times change and people are really reexamining and reimagining lives, I think it's even more important to acknowledge that, like, family structures are all so valid. Families might be two people. Families might be one person and the community they build. Like, there's no definition of family. I grew up, my dad's childhood best friends were my uncles, and they were as much of, if not more, uncles to me than any blood relative. And when my father passed, they were the ones that held me up and continue. And when Isaac was born, the first people I wanted to tell about it. And I think that's really important. I know I mentioned earlier also the way we kind of raise Isaac in our synagogue spaces and really looking at that as our neighborhood. And those are the people in his neighborhood. And that's been really, really important to Isaac, especially since we did move. And maintaining those relationships, because that is what family is. And kind of knowing that and knowing it's important that you have to work at those relationships. It doesn't just kind of happen, even with family and chosen family. So knowing family is what you make of it and can be whoever you want it to be.
And it wouldn't be us without having a Disney reference. So I pulled it up so I wouldn't butcher this one. But, you know, Lilo and Stitch, the classic Disney tale. Ohana means family. Family means nobody gets left behind or forgotten. And, like, I think that nailed it, right? I think that's one of the most memorable Disney quotes. And you see it on shirts of families when they're at Disney World. But, like,
not our family.
Not our family.
To be clear.
I won't do matching shirts. But Disney, you know, I think that that message applies because at the end of the day, family, as Elisa said, is whatever you construct it to be. But family means no one will be left behind or forgotten.
I really appreciate all of that, including, you know, who is into and not into the matching shirts. Gabe, as someone in my chosen family, as I wrote in the acknowledgments for my thesis a few weeks ago, what do you think about this?
You know, since you told me the question, I've been toying around with a bunch of different answers in my head, and I didn't really like any of them. But I keep coming back to this image in my head of being away from my family, being at Jewish summer camp for my first summer. I was an Eisner camper, and I have this really vivid image in my head of on Shabbat sitting at dinner, and everybody at the camp after Kiddush, everybody put their arms around each other for the priestly blessing for Yivarechecha. And it was just this really intense moment of, like, not only being one community, but of being one family. I had always known that prayer, that blessing, as being something that my parents said, or being something that parents said specifically to their children. The rabbi would say, put your hands on your child's head. And then all of a sudden, there was this moment where, you know, 1,000 people were putting their arms around each other and saying those same words. So I think, yes, sometimes family can just be you and your grown-ups, whatever that means to you. But sometimes family is the whole community, and that can be just as, if not more, beautiful.
I was trying to think of what my answer would be, and you just inspired me, Gabe, of memory. So we talked about this possibly being replayed around Passover time, which means Elise and Jason, you're going to be famous. Maybe you'll get heard at least twice. But I have to tell you, so at our Passover Seders, we always had something like 20 people around the table. And it was nuts. And there were always Jewish people and non-Jewish people around the table because my mom loves to host people for Passover. And she takes the let all who are hungry come and eat very seriously. But one of the things that she did was we always had very close friends that we would invite over. And whether they were Jewish, not Jewish, they were there. And for those who were not Jewish, to take a step back. Part of the Passover Seder involves the four children that each child is read and talked about. And my mom would write parts of the Irish Catholic child and the Italian child, you know, for our friends that would come visit that, like, you know, like how we're not Jewish, so that they would have a piece of the Seder that they could play a part of. And her feeling, my mother has always been everyone's mother, but her feeling was for that evening, they were adopted into the Passover family and they were adopted into the Passover story. And I think that speaks a little bit to both Elisa and Jason's point before, which is the stories we tell matter and our origin stories matter. And when we're able to help others read themselves into the stories, there's a really incredible opportunity for connectedness that didn't exist before that. And that's all part of a major conversation. And you know, Elisa and Jason, I know that both of you are always willing to have this type of conversation, as well as many others. And so, Elisa, Jason, if people want to continue this conversation or get more resources or just ask some questions, how can they best find or follow you?
So mine is my email, which is my name, and it's really alizaplotkin @gmail.com. And that's really the best way to get in touch.
The easiest way to get in touch with me is through the synagogue, just jplotkin, jplotkin @temple-israel.org. You can always call the temple Israel in West Bloomfield too. And that's the best way to get a hold of me.
And to be clear, it's the West Bloomfield Temple Israel, not one of the other hundreds of Temple Israels.
to be fair.
I'm really excited for people to be able to continue this conversation and also for us to spread out a maybe unfamiliar topic with people who hopefully are going to embrace a new story or a new way of looking at this story. And I think that's been incredibly uplifting and also a little bit liberating to get out of the way that we normally are in this story of slavery to liberation, right? Maybe being able to look at it just through a bit of a different lens. And so, Aliza, Jason, thank you so much for sharing your story and also welcoming us to look at things slightly in a different lens in a new way. Thank you to Gabe for drawing names out of the water each week and also for ensuring that Jason still got his list of names as quickly as possible in the beginning of your rundown. I saw the smiles and nods as you went through it. Thank you, Edan, for making sure that this episode was beautifully put together, especially when we have two members of Team Plotkin in one room and one microphone. And thank you to our listeners. As always, we couldn't do this without you. Stay tuned. Our conclusion's coming at you next. Okay, this is a little embarrassing to admit, Gabe, but I have to tell you that even though I know that Passover is a family holiday and I know that the Exodus is the story of the Jewish people, I'm not really sure I ever thought about how much Shemot talks about the different ways of structuring a family.
I certainly never thought about it in the way that you kind of broke it down into chapter one, chapter two, chapter three. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, well, a lot of that is what happens when you bring in different people's perspectives. I mean, part of what we've been doing in this podcast is trying to lift up as many diverse voices as possible. And I know, I get it. We made a joke in the intro about the fact that we've brought in people who have been here before. But I have to tell you that when Aliza brought up this idea of talking about adoption, it occurred to me that Shemot was an excellent, excellent parsha for us to connect this with. And so I think it was a really neat way to talk about a topic that I just had never really thought so much about before.
You know, Shemot deals so much with Moses' identity as an Israelite, as an Egyptian, as a Midianite, and kind of figuring out who he is. And for us as Jews in the modern world, we also have complex and intersecting identities. And all of us kind of need to figure out where we stand in relationship to those different identities, and in particular, our relationship to the Jewish people. I think it's a really incredible thing that Jason and Aliza have not only chosen to bring somebody into their family through the adoption process, but even more amazing that they've done it with such intention in a Jewish way, such Jewish mindfulness.
I will also tell you that just in terms of, you know, once you start looking for something, you can see it everywhere. Those examples that I gave during the episode include, are, by the way, not the only Jewish traditional textual examples of adoption. But I had never really thought about the facts, right? That Ruth and Naomi were a story, that Esther and Mordecai were a story, that Michal had raised up children that weren't her children, you know, with David. And so I think it's really interesting that one could actually argue that adoption is not only just a Jewish value, but is actually really deeply embedded in the Jewish tradition and in Jewish leadership in the Jewish tradition.
It is really incredible how we find our foundations. It is really interesting that so many of our foundational narratives have these characters who are so complex that they almost don't seem legendary or mythical anymore. They seem like actual people. They seem like, you know, people we would meet today with complex and rich and contradictory backstories. I think it's not at all difficult to imagine a person like Moses who has real difficulty understanding who he is and how he fits into his community, and yet coming up and becoming a true leader of his people.
Absolutely. And look, stories is where it's at. I mean, that's what we got started with when we brought this podcast into life, was the ability to share stories that were special and different and important and hopefully resonant with the people listening. And so we hope that you've enjoyed today's episode as maybe looking at Judaism through a different lens and maybe embracing a new type of story or a new type of family. And we do actually hope that you'll listen to this again around Passover time as a reminder that our stories are woven together in really complex and intricate ways, but are also a vehicle for connecting us in a way that we may have never looked at before. And so for us, we are so happy to have you around our Seder table, even in January, right? Passover in January, I guess. But to invite you into this tradition as part of the Drinking and Droshing family. And we raise our glasses to you and wish you a wonderful, again, 2023 and a wonderful beginning of a new book of Shemot. We hope that your name is written into this year of good living. And we look forward to seeing you next week for our next episode. L'chaim.
Hi, I'm Aliza Plotkin, and you're listening to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist. And it's important to note that there has been a cat on Jason's feet asleep this whole time.